Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul France, owner of France Games. I run SMB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just when my minor had a joint, we have talkcast every Thursday night starting 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either join us on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions. Call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the Talks website at www.talkshoe.com and search for Call ID 17702. And remember to use Chrome browser. And, of course, we have the YouTube stream, which is various all over the place. Check Twitter. Check the Discord server. You can also check Facebook. And you also can check the discussion board, of course. It's all over the place. I try to cover pretty well. But that's another way of listening to the show live and also participating. Also, of course, if you want to contact me, you can email me at sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's S-F-U-O-N-C-A-L-L. Also, if you want to reach me via Skype, my Skype ID is Franz Games, F-R-A-N-Z-G-M-E-S. And, of course, you can follow me on the Twitters, my podcast account, SFU On Call. That's where I announce all these beautiful podcasts. If you want to discuss things with me, you can more than happy to follow my personal account, the Paul Franz, and just go to twitter.com/PaulFranz. Follow all kinds of people, especially the Pope, because I'm Catholic. But more importantly, it's various things. So, and of course, there's my tertiary account, Friends Games, where I announce the clients' updates and also other things that are going on with Friends Games, including stuff when it comes to Starfleet Warlord. And of course, this lovely talkcast gets turned to a podcast and available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Some quick news from ADB this week. Steve Cole was busy working at his desk for 2 to 3 hours per day per his doctor's orders. That he couldn't work more than that. He's recovering from surgery nicely. Also, he worked on Capitalog number 53, the blogs, and also the art for the Gorn Master Starship book. All the Battle Destroyers got done. Wow, there's quite a few of those. And also the art for the GURPS Prime Directive Revision. Yay! Some more progress on the GURPS Prime Directive Revision. Also, Steve Petcher was busy working on SMB updates, also on the Gorn Master Starship book, and also keeping busy with answering questions on the discussion board. Jean was also busy working on the GURPS Prime Directive Revision. Always good to see all the progress she's made. She actually had some people she sent some of the chapters out to and had them go, she said that there were some formatting errors that needed to be corrected. I didn't remember her mentioning anything else about the content needing to be corrected, which invariably it does. You're a writer, you screw up, you know. I've got a story on that one if you ever wanted to know. Moving forward to the SMB Online tournaments, unfortunately, both the RAT 48 tournament run by Ron Brennmeyer, which has two games completed in round three, and still need two more to get done. And of course, we have one round four game set up. And also the Masters tournament, only five of the round two games have been completed, including my game. We're still waiting for three more to get done there, and we need to get that thing done. I might have to start just sending emails on a weekly basis to people to find out what's going on with those games. Moving onward and forward to the library progress for the library report for this week. The progress, actually, there was some progress, and actually, yes, I did get around to doing it, as I said last week, and actually processed those 10 paladines. So now, completed conversions are all the way up to 2,444, yet to be converted to 881. That brings us to a percent complete all the way up to 73.5%. So we're getting closer. You know, that's always good to see progress, no matter how small, because each one is one less to be converted, that little bit closer to being completed. And with that is the news for this week. And it's me, it's the one, the only Paul Franz, welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, We have, of course,
me.
Hey, you're listening to me. You're here to listen to me, you know. And of course, what else we have? Our ever so faithful friend Dave. He is here tonight. And tonight we're gonna have a couple discussions and see how things go, because you never know. As I always mention about topics, there's the topics for tonight, and there's something to change without notice. Ta-da! Invariably, that does happen, because sometimes we have people stop by. Sometimes I just run out of things to talk about on that particular topic, or between the time I come up with the topics and the time I actually have the show, I actually go, you know, I got a better topic in mind. So I changed my mind. Tonight, at the moment, I don't plan on changing my mind, but hey, you never know what it'll take to change your mind. But moving forward, tonight we are going to start with a topic that was actually kind of mentioned last week when it comes to speed SFB play, or speeding up SFB play. This was mentioned by a person on the discussion board, Mark. And he mentioned this, and it's like, I've seen them, i.e. chess clocks. So I don't want to talk about chess clocks. And it's like, okay, I've seen them in movies, you know, or invariably documentaries, you know, where you see these guys playing chess. One hits the clock, and the other person, they finish their move, and then they hit the clock, and then they go back and forth. It's like, what is that all about, you know? So tonight we're actually going to talk about the use of a chess clock in SFB. How it could be implemented. What is it actually usable in SFB form? Because I like the idea of chess clock. Okay, let me go back to what I did a little bit of reading on the chess clock. And let me just look at this. Okay. I found this perfect, this beautiful page that describes exactly what I want to know about. And basically, it says you start the chess game. Okay, boy plays makes first move. Players shake hands, and then the black side presses the play button, and then you continue on from there. When your opponent makes a move, he will press the button on his side, which stops his timer, and starts yours, the other person's timer. And then that happens to every move. You'll press the button. It seems tedious at first, but soon comes skill that you can perform slowly, rapidly. Basically, it's just repetitive. Just if you get used to hitting the clock, boom, 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 you know, go back and forth, and you're fine. And I totally understand that. How the game ends with a timer. Time management in a chessboard is fascinating in its own right and can be learned about. And much can be learned about this topic. The last 5 minutes, regardless of timing strategy, an analog display there's a red flag that will raise as the time approaches expiration. When it falls, that time has expired. Players whose time has expired loses the game. The other player claims the win, and there are some interesting rules and etiquette for later. But anyway, so the whole idea of a chess clock, for those who are not unfamiliar with chess clocks, and as I said, I was unfamiliar, so I did a little reading and I found them kind of fascinating, especially the whole idea of a chess clock. The whole idea of a chess clock, and with chess, it's actually relatively simple. Because you have two sides, all you do is moving pieces on the board. Okay. The whole idea is that you want to get a game done within a certain period of time. And to make sure that neither person uses a disproportionate amount of that time, what you do is use a chess clock. The chess clock will... You basically set the timer to be equivalent, equal for both players. For example, the one example they give of the showing a chess clock, a digital one, which says 1 hour and 30 minutes. So each player gets 1 hour and 30 minutes to play, make all of the moves for the entire game. Obviously, the game can be over before those 3 hours are up. And that's fine. But also, it limits it. So each person has 1 hour and 30 minutes to use however they want. If they want to take 5 minutes for a single move, that's their priority, their prerogative to do that. But, you know, at the same time, the longer they spend on one move, the less time they will have on a future move. Which is itself interesting. And depending upon the clock, what will happen is that that when you press your side, you can give extra time to your opponent, i.e., here it is. They were showing an example of a clock, and what they said is that in the photo, there's a digital timer which is set to an hour and 30 minutes with a bonus time of 5 seconds per move. So basically, for each move that a person takes, you get an additional 5 seconds. The idea being is that you want to minimize the number of moves, therefore minimize the amount of extra time you give your opponent. Which is interesting. Obviously, that kind of thing would be irrelevant when it comes to SFP, you know, because each person has a certain amount of moves, period. That's defined by their speed. So giving them additional time based on your move is kind of crazy. Now, to me, the use of a chess timer is an interesting idea. I like the idea in that it's a way of limiting the game to a certain period of time, and it forces you to make quick decisions. And as I said, you can either, you know, if you use up more time earlier, you have less time later. And as was pointed out in the instructions for using a chess clock, if you run out of time before the game is over, you lose. Plain and simple. You have no more time to use. So you lose the game. Now, I'm not sure how that actually works. I'm assuming in a chess tournament, you know, if you run out of time or you actually lose to your opponent, it's the same thing. I'm not sure if there are points that will vary based on how you win. This reminds me of how originally Ken Burnside set up the FedCom tournament. The whole idea is that you would get a certain number of points, kind of a victory points kind of thing, and you can add up the number of victory points, and then you would, the person with the most victory points then would be the winner for that round of the tournament, which is a neat idea. I disagree with it. I think the use of victory points is a good thing, in that if you use the use of victory points in the tournament itself is good, in that if you want to set, say that you basically going for, if you're re-bracketing for each round, or that you have a control style game, tournament, where you just you play as many games as you can possibly play. Then the person with the most victory points, okay, they're considered the best player. But you'll be in or out to the actual next round, depending upon if you won or if you won enough games or not. You know, if you're plus or minus. Make sure you're a positive net kill. So I like that sidetrack there. But the thing is, when it comes to using a chess timer, a chess clock, when it comes to SFB, the question is, how could you use that? In my mind, okay, we have to split it up into multiple phasers, the way I see it. You have a set timer. No, this is not a chess timer, but a regular timer for EAs. Each person has a certain set time for EAs, period. Because it's one of those things, it's not like in a chess game. In a chess game, it's a sequence. You move, your opponent moves. You move, your opponent moves. It just goes back and forth. And that's why a chess clock works so well. And that is that each move for each person, you know, it's the same number of moves. Whichever player plays, you know, in a game, you're gonna have each person's gonna have basically the same number of moves. It's not like you can skip. You say, oh, I don't plan on moving. I'm gonna skip. No, you never know. There might be actually a variant of chess where you can say, I'm skipping. You know, you can move and I won't move. Some places where, you know, rules of war? I think sometimes the only move is not to move or something like that. Or something along those lines. So you have set time for EAs, and then each turn you set a clock for each turn. And each person would get, what, 15 minutes? How long do you want those turns to be? Do you want them to be 30 minutes long, a maximum? Or do you want... I was thinking about, you know, 15 minutes. I was like, no, 15 minutes is way too short to be playing. So, I mean, for a turn. So 30 minutes, a 30 minute turn is still kind of quick, but it's doable and not too crazy. Obviously, the more that happens in a turn you'd want to have more time, but it just means you have to think faster or have things planned ahead of time. Or more importantly, it's do what they do in chess, which is while your opponent is making their moves, you're thinking. Which again leads you to the realization that you don't want to spend too much time in chess making your move. Why? Because you give your opponent a larger period of time to think about counter moves to any moves that you're going to make. And you keep doing that, and your opponent keeps on staying ahead of you when it comes to the clock. Your opponent, in some cases, all he needs to do is, I'd say working for a tie, but it's a possibility. But in chess, it's harder to do because there's a maximum number of moves, really. And your opponent's going to be aggressive and is going to want to take your piece. And when you're down to like your last piece, or last couple pieces, you're dead. But anyhow, and then each person, you know, and you could use a chess clock at that point for each term. So that if you want to take up more time deciding where you're going to move, that's fine. Of course, again, I come back to last week and the whole idea of S&B speed play. And that is, what do you do? What is the penalty? What is the penalty if your opponent does not, you know, runs out of time? In the case of S&B for the turn, what do you want to do? Do we want to have it so basically that's a dead man switch kind of thing? I.e., if you run out of time, everything blows up and you lose. You know? Because previously on the speed play, the whole idea was that the penalties were lessened, i.e., okay, EA, which was the most difficult thing, which was to min speed, or first the minimum speed and then possibly the maximum speed that's closest to that. In EA, don't charge any weapons except for, you know, have standard housekeeping. Not sure about Wild Wizards and Suicide Shuttles. You know, if those, I would assume you could probably, if the client understood it, I would think then you also hold those. So housekeeping and holding the previous special shuttles. You know, and that's it for EA, which is a pretty, pretty harsh penalty. But, you know, you want to keep that going. Impulse activity, you just don't get to actually have an impulse activity. A lot of times that's not a big deal. And then when it comes to move, okay, if you actually are moving, if your ship does move, then the ship moves straight ahead, which is always valid. And in some cases, dangerous, because if you're right next to the wall, when it comes to tournament play, you run into the wall and boom, you're stopped dead. It doesn't kill you, but obviously in some cases, it can be quite deadly. So I remember running into the wall with Andromeda because I couldn't turn. That was a bad situation all around. Bad situation all around. Because of, if I didn't hit, he was going to get on a really weak PA panel. If I did hit, I'm probably going to have to run into the wall at some point. So I just delayed it. And then, of course, what happens? I run into the wall. The funny part to me is I didn't die at that exact moment. I died later on when I actually started building up speed again. And it wasn't that it was against a Klingon. It wasn't that his drones overtook me and killed me that way. It was more of we were doing a knife fight and he just kept on bopping the crap out of me. So, there you have. So, I think, obviously, I think the easiest is having on a per turn basis. And then if you run out of time for your turn, you lose. Plain simple. You know? But that's another way of using a timer in SFB to speed up play. And again, some of these ideas that I have, and I would really like to find an opponent who'd be willing to try them out. I have to do a little research to see if there's any chess clocks, you know, online chess clocks where you could actually play online. If not, I might have to create one myself. And that is the ability to create a chess clock online so that you click and the other person clicks, and you know, and then your timers start and stop based on when you click and your opponent clicks. I know there's chess clocks on the internet. The only question is, will they work over the internet? Meaning, each opponent is on a different side of the computer. And so it actually works over the internet, not that you use a chess clock that uses like your keyboard on your computer, and each person will press a different key to simulate the different clock things. So each person and it just runs locally, basically. I have to look. I'll look for that a little bit, probably tonight or tomorrow. So it should be interesting to see how that, if I can find that out, and maybe see if I can, get someone to volunteer to play online with me, SAP, and using a chess clock, and see if, because I'd be willing to try it out. So, okay, we will move on to the next topic. The next topic is the Starfleet Warlord Automation Progress. That's one thing that I've, when I worked on it this past weekend, a little bit, not a great amount, but I did get some progress. I decided to go for the most basic of things. I forgot if I announced that last week or not. I'll mention it anyway. I did get one piece of Starfleet Warlord to be completely automated. I.e. that it's a command line. You just pass in to the command line what is the on the command line, what is the whatchamacallit? Sorry. The corporation. The corporation that wins. That's one I still have to figure out how to do. And that is, I probably have to create a utility that will give me a report of who is winning. And then some way of finding out who won, after we run the end, or have that come out as an output, separate output, just to confirm that who I actually entered is the winner. Because you can enter, that's kind of those crazy things when it comes to the Starfleet Warlord end program, when the program you run at the end to create the final results, in that you can say, oh, this one's the winner, but it might not be the winner, especially when it comes to Die Hard. The points that are finally scored at the very end might be a little bit off if they're close. A lot of times, if there's a big lead, i.e., when it comes to major sites or sectors, if there's a big lead, there's no concern. But then once in a while, that's not correct. That's why when you first thing you do is you run your last turn, complete that turn, then you do a backup, and then you run the end program. So for that, it's relatively simple. And since the UI for the end utility is simple, it basically asks you for a corporation number, and that's it. And then it runs. Now, a couple of things I still have to look into when it comes to automating it, and that is when the program crashes, quote unquote crashes, because some of it's still runtime when it comes to figuring out. That's one thing I found out this week, which was to me is one of the craziest programming contexts I've ever known, and that is inheritance when it comes to function calls. Here's how it works. If you define a variable as private for a function within Clipper, and you call another function, that function that you just called, it has access to those private variables that you defined in the function that called that function. It's like, okay. Now, if you define it as local, then that is not, those variables are not inherited. So, I found that, unfortunately, there's an old book I have on Clipboard 5.2, which I kept. And that actually describes exactly the situation and helped me understand. I was looking into combat, because combat, there's been some squawking that combat, oh, it's not fair, you know, da da da. It's like, okay, well, let's see. Maybe, just maybe, because I've run into some of these issues with the Harbor, because Harbor basically takes the Clipper programs and compiles them into an actual executable. Actually, it does a cross-compile from Clipper into C, and then from C, it creates an actual app. You know, so, which is good. But the one thing I haven't looked into is if Harbor has a way of auto-quitting. Because what happens if it quote-unquote fails, there's an error in the program. It interactively asks you, do you want to quit? And if I want to have this as an automated thing, it can't be asking for quitting. It has to automatically quit and probably return an error or something like that, and which is fine. I don't mind if it returns errors, because I can capture errors, and I can then have it, for automations, I can have it send me an email, a notification, basically, telling me that something wrong happened. But if it does what it currently does, which is, it prompts you for if you want to quit or not, then it just stuck. It's a hung process. It just sits there, you know. And if the problem, here's the big problem, if you have multiple people all running that same program and it runs the same issue, I could have hundreds or thousands of programs, some cases from a single person, running on the system that are just hung. And it's taking up resources until I possibly have to restart the whole server just because I have all these dead processes that are running, that taking up memory and taking up resources. So I have to look into that particular issue. But to say the least, at least I got that part done. The next part was that I wanted to work on the other end of things, the starting. Basically, I'm trying to get some of the most simplest forms, and I looked at some of the UI part of the Warlord program, especially the creation of the galaxies, you know, basically creating the game, starting the games. You have this program which you run, and it creates the galaxy, places the monsters, places the pirates, and all this kind of stuff. And that's one of the things that currently I have to do step by step by step by step by step. When really what I want to do is hit one button. Boom. It creates it. To a certain degree. There's certain things that have to be set up for it. Number one, it has to actually set the size, set other minor parameters about what it actually creates this game. Fine. There's other things that need to be done. And the one thing that I did, which was the most simplest thing, which was setting the rules. Because of currently, you might, if for different, depending upon the game, you might actually want to tweak the rules to be this way or that way. And I looked at the code, and it's actually pretty simple the way it sets the rules. Because it sets... there's a string, and then one position the string represents a rule. Pretty basic stuff. But I wanted to have a program so I could turn a rule on or off. So, i.e., to automate the whole thing. So if I really wanted to, what I can do is, on the outside, I can just say, okay, here's my game, here's my rules I want to use, here's the size. and then run that as a background run, and that run that into a background process, which then calls the individual pieces of Starfleet Warlord engine, and then creates the game. Ta da! Awesome. Ran into some minor issues, which I'm glad I ran into, because I did. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure I told you the how I actually got to. I ported from Windows to be into a non-Windows platform, and I was able to successfully do that. Well, kind of successfully do it. I realized there's some other APIs which don't translate well. Again, it's one of those things. It's Clipper. And it's some strangeness. In this case, the strangeness that I was seeing related to this is that if you call, there's an API called file. I thought, give the a full path name and it'll tell you if the file exists. Actually, it's smarter than, it's too smart for its own good. If you give it an absolute path, it will always say, no, we can't find the file. So it's not really, it won't tell you if a file in a given path exists. It will, if you give it a file name, no path, no directory structure at all, then it will tell you if it can find that file. There's certain things like it might be in the actual path, you know, and it'll search that. And things like that, that's what it will look for. So usually it's in the current directory, and that's what this finds in the current directory, and you're fine. But I changed it so that everything that gets passed into all these programs, all these functions, are absolute paths, you know, so that I don't have to. And a lot of stuff is right now, I've got it all environment variable driven. I figure that's the easiest way to get that information into the program. That might change. I might change that so that it actually reads a file, a configuration file, which is for that game. You know, if it reads in, okay, this is the location of the game file, this is the location of the turns. Well, that's another couple other things that I did, which was there are certain things I assumed. I changed some of the logic for the engine, i.e., currently the way the engine works, you actually define where the turns are going to be going to be put after they're executed. I changed that. What happens is, okay, we know where the game files are located. We got that directory. Assume that all the turns are always in the turns directory. Period. Backup directory is always the. Well, actually, I don't think you can define. Yeah, you can't set that. That's by default. That's, you know, it's by convention. The backup directory for the game files are is in the backup directory. Underneath the game directory. So, big surprise. But. So, you know, that's some of the things that change. Just like for some things that I plan on changing is for execution of turns. The assumption is that there is no entering of orders manually. No more. For this part of it, it's all going to be automated. The whole idea is that you submit your orders, it will run them. Boom. End of story. There'll be no human interaction, at least hopefully, to process them. You submit them. Everyone has their orders all submitted for the turn, for that game turn. It then will go boom, 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 execute all of those orders, and then spit them out. Or at some point, I have to do the other thing, which is if, you know, have the timeout for the game, hit it, click in, so that, okay, we've got 75% of the orders are in. At that point, Ron, you know, and it's 7:30 or whatever time I set. So, okay, this is the deadline. If you do not have your turns in by it's run anyway, there is no if, ands, or but. Sorry. You're late. It just runs. And I know that's going to make quite a few people happy. Some other people are going to be very sad because of what happens, you know, if I can't, you know. So, you know, I end up in the hospital over the weekend. Well, at the same time, it was over a weekend. Dude, why didn't you have it done the week before? But I think I already explained that when it comes to Starfleet Warlord. And that is, in some cases, you want to wait close to the last second because of this is part of Starfleet Warlord is, of course, the diplomacy aspect to the game. That is making the deals. And it might take you a few days to actually work on the deal because of communication can be very slow. Which is, it can be slow or it could be, you know, internet speed. I was just kind of thinking about the quirkiness of that whole situation. And that is, we have all this technology which can keep us quite connected to one another. But at the same time, it doesn't speed up us communicating with one another. At least in some cases, it does not. And why is that? Because in my mind, I think part of that is just that we all get this overburdened. We get so much, you know, communication that okay, it takes us longer to get through all the rest of the crap communication to get to what we actually want to respond to. In some cases, I know I'm the way I work, and I know this is not really a good thing and be something to be proud of, and I'm not really proud of it. It's just I know it's the way things I work, which is the longer an email is, the longer it takes me to get to it because of this fact. And that is, I know that if it's a longer email, it's going to take me longer to understand what the person wants. The longer it takes me to actually to figure out what the person wants, or you know, how I'm going to have to respond to it, it's going to take me longer, the longer I put it off, because I usually don't have, I just don't want to deal with it, because if it's too long, it's like, okay, because if it's something I can get done with quickly, you know, I can respond to it in like a minute, great. If it's something I'm going to read for, take me 5 to 15 minutes, and it's going to take me 30 minutes to respond to, you know, because invariably that's one thing that drives me crazy sometimes with the corrections to people that, you know, I screw up and they ask me, oh, can you correct this? The problem is the first thing I have to do, I have to verify that what you're telling me is true, because I'm sorry, I can't trust you. You got ulterior motive. You might want to actually get a one up on your opponent. So I really can't trust you in that process. So sorry, but that's the way things work. So that just takes longer to correct things than it is to hopefully get it right the first time. I try to get first right the first time, but don't always happen. Another reason why I wanted to have it so it's automated, because if it's everything's completely automated, what does that mean? That means if something messes up, when it comes to entering the orders, it's your fault. So there's only one person to complain, and that's you. That means there is no correction. The only time it might be a correction is if the tool given does not correctly tell you that, oh, it didn't recognize that this was an invalid order. And that's actually something I had to correct for Chuck. Yeah. Chuck, you know, he entered in I think it was GY for the graveyard. It's not GY, it's GS, graveyard sector is what it is. That's the sector selection when it comes to Warlord for the graveyard sector. So he said, oh, GY, you know, and I think whether he entered in GS or GY, it both gave it invalid. So he just said, oh, it must be GY, and just enter and let it go anyway. So I had to help correct that, or it accepted it. I doubt it accepted it, because I'm pretty sure. But I think the problem is also it wouldn't accept GS, which is the proper way of defining that you're using the grave, that the hex that you're currently locating, like for fortifying a site, is in the graveyard sector. Actually, that's one thing I need to look into, really. And that's one thing with the engine, which is the engine. The crazy part is when it comes to looking at Galaxy, you know, the engine has the ability to, you know, say, okay, I want to look at this sector. And you say sector and you say give it a number. The problem is that if you give it GS, it gives you sector 00. So it's like, okay, so you never meant to look at the graveyard sector through the aid. Obviously, you can do it, because in Clipper you have some tools. It's called DBU, and actually for Clipper you actually compile it yourself, which is kind of interesting if you think about it. They give you the source code to do it, to compile it. And so you do it that way. And actually, Harbor, you have to apply a certain patch to those utilities so you can compile them. And actually, the first time I applied the patch, I applied the wrong patch, because there's two different patches, one for one version, one for the other version. I thought I was applying for the right version. I was wrong. But anyhow, when it comes to, so that means, okay, so I mean, when it comes to progress, I've gotten so that I can create the end part. Fine. I can set the rules however they need to be set. I have to go through. This is one thing I was actually deciding on, which was, do I now have it, again, completely automated? Instead of having it run each step, just have it so that it automatically runs all the steps. Which is what I'm thinking about at the moment. Which is just have it so that we have the set rule little program which sets the rules. I'm thinking about having a file that which gets read in, which defines the rules, that defines the setup for the game, defines the sectors, the wild sectors, because what is, you create a map of which sectors can be used by corporations, which sectors cannot be used by corporations, and going forth from there. One thing I found out, as I think I mentioned before, which is in some games, like the actual standard game, it actually uses different game files, different database files, because of it requires certain columns that don't normally exist in a Die Hard game. And those are for GIFs. There are certain columns for allowing the support of GIFs. GIFs. GIFTS, not GIFs, you know, as in the image file format. So it's going well, you know. But I said, I'm glad I've gotten to this point. So it wasn't one of those things that I thought I plan on getting going, but I was able to get started on it and got through it quite well. I initially did it with the environment variables, and I might just stay there at the moment. I might at some point change that to be loaded in as configuration file from the hard drive, and just have it so that as the first step is that it reads in the information about the configuration for which you're running, as in like as a either convention, i.e. it's in the current directory, or as something that gets passed in. I want it to actually be passed in because of this. I want this whole thing to be running on a server, so that if I'm running on a server, then, and I have all these parameters set up so that it can be anywhere on that system, I don't have to worry about current directories. What is the current directory of this process going to be running in? This, no, don't worry about that. That's why you have all of these configurations. But anyhow, it's coming quite well. I cleaned things up and have it so that now it's in a Mercurial repository. So I can keep track of everything, all the changes and all that kind of thing, which I think is good. Now, this is the big question, which is, because now that I have it actually compiling and running on the Mac, when do I do the switch? Because one of the things that, unbeknownst to some of the Starfleet Warlords players out there, which I'm not sure how many actually are listening to this, those players, the one of the things I have to do every single time that I run the orders, I have to bring up a Windows VM each and every time. And if I could run it actually completely locally within my Mac, don't have to bring up a VM of Windows. If I can run everything locally on my Mac, I could speed up the process a heck of a lot longer, a heck of a lot quicker. Because as it is, my current process is a lot faster than the previous one. In other words, actually using DOSBox to run the DOS programs on my Mac. Of course, here's always the gotcha. This is the one thing that's, I'm not so I'm concerned about this. It's always in the back of my mind. It's always in the back of my mind when it comes to Starfleet Warlord. And that is the executable that I got from Bruce Graw all those years ago. And the code I got from Bruce Graw all those years ago is the executable that he gave me. Does that match? Is that from the code that he gave me? Are those in sync? Here's why I asked that question, because it always was running concern with me. And that is, every once in a while, players report a glitch. And I find out, and sometimes I find out about the glitch, like the one of the glitches that I found out was that the percentage wasn't being calculated properly for the how much you've progressed when it comes to your stocks. It always was considered zero, and I'm not sure anyone told me about it. So I saw someone post about it on Facebook. So I found out about it. I fixed it in the engine after I figured out exactly what was going on. This is why I was looking into the combat stuff earlier this past week, because I'm looking for this issue. The issue is that with Clipper, you have a certain size of your column, a certain size of your variable. I have to double. I'll confirm this on with the book I got. And if when it comes to Harbor if you don't, if one variable is 8 characters, the other variable is 10, those two variables actually can be considered the same variable under Clipper. But under Harbor, it's two different variables. And that's why I ran into the issue with the report showing zero. So I was wondering if the same thing was happening with combats, because they were saying combat, you know, was not quite right. Of course, I come to find out that Bruce Grawl grabbed a simple random number generator. I mean, really simple. I'm looking at this code and I'm going, how is this a random number generator? Of course, I don't understand the algorithm. So, and I mean, it's real simple. Because you multiply, it's like basically the value of pi times, I think it's like the date, month, and year split up and then divided by 1,000. And then the seed, what you do with the seed is each time you randomize, you multiply it by 997. I don't know. These are magic numbers. And I looked at that. I did just for giggles. I grabbed the algorithm and I just decided to roll dice. And I looked at it and I actually did some quick calculations. And to be honest, it's not that bad. I calculated out when it comes to for 20, basically a 20-sided die. That's what I did. I rolled a 20-sided die, rolled it for like 20 times. And I calculated it out. I did a quick average. It's a tiny bit high. But at the same time, I was only 20 rolls. So it was, you know, it was like 11.6 is what it was. It averaged out the die rolls to be 11.6, which is a little high. But, you know, so to me, that's not bad considering. And I looked at the numbers, because originally I looked at the numbers and I looked at it and went, you know, this seems a little too roller coaster like, i.e., there were a lot of lows and a lot of highs. And I realized that actually that probably was not the case. Of course, one thing that I also found when it comes to the combat is that originally I thought, oh, it's a simple die roll. Okay, if there's 400 damage, you know, that their attack factor is like 400. And the idea is that you split up that 400 by the number of ships that you're actually attacking. And yeah, by the number of ships that you're attacking. Yeah. And then you do a randomization and you attack, you get to apply that amount of damage to each ship. You have to do a random for each ship that you're attacking. And let's say that you have 10 ships and that you're attacking with, your attack factor is 400. That means you have 40 points of damage that you can do to those 10 ships. So, you roll the die, so you do a randomization based on the 40 points of damage. But the one thing I did find out is actually it splits it up into die rolls of D10s. So, in the case of 40 points of damage, you know, if you type in, okay, into this function, you have 40. Pass it in. Actually, it's like rolling 4 10-sided die, which tells me basically things overall are rolled high. Is it possible to roll low? Yes, it's possible to roll low. But the minimum amount of damage when it comes to 40 points of damage is 4 points of damage. Not 1, 4. What's the maximum number? Of course, it's still 40. The question obviously would be that when it comes to the average damage, does the average damage actually increase because of the way that it's a D10s? Probably, you know, versus a D40 where you have 1 in 40 chance, you actually have the amount of damage is actually the bell curve is what it is. You know, if you go down to like SFB the same way, you have 2 6-sided die instead of 1 12-sided die. That actually produces a different results. You know, 7 being the greatest number. So the mid numbers are the greatest amount that you could possibly get. So in other words, that when it comes to that 40, you should be maxing out. Most probable is 20. So, so that was some, that was one of the things that I found in the code base, which I thought was kind of interesting. But you know, I'll look at it a little more just to make sure that I didn't miss something, because I know there has been some complaints about like go against the defender where you have a, you know, it's within like 10%. You have 10% more attack factors than your opponent has defensive factors, and you still lose. And some people, and see, this is one of those things that I have to explain to people sometimes, which is just because you have the strongest fleet doesn't mean that you will win, because we have that random factor in there, because it is possible that you will lose. And people get upset when they say, oh, yeah, but I have a stronger fleet. It's like, yeah, you have a stronger fleet, but you can still lose. If you look at the randomizations, you know, you will see how that goes. Now, that's actually one thing I wanted to change about the engine. And that is, currently, those results are not saved anywhere. And I know that I get questioned on the results not all the time, but enough times that I think I need to start saving those results. So I need to change the engine to not just output them to the screen, but output them to a file, which then keeps like a battle log of all the battles that have been taking place for that turn. And then, so that anytime I can look at the, I can go back and review the battles themselves. Because at the moment, I don't see any way of doing that outside of that. So I think with that, we will draw this to a close. Had a little discussion about, of course, using chess clocks in SFB play, which I think could provide a way of speeding up play. And I would love to see if anyone would volunteer. Maybe I can find someone online like Neon Pico or one of the other players that would be willing to do it. I have to make sure that there's a chess clock online that we can actually use for said things. And of course, the discussion of where I am in Starfleet Warlord and getting the whole thing automated so that we can actually improve the process, have the process run faster, and hopefully take the human, me, out of the equation, which I think would be a fantastic idea. If we can get me out of the equation, I think we can actually have this go a lot quicker. Also, obviously, if we can get everyone to use the aid or some kind of automated tool to submit their orders, then we'll even be better off. And with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.